Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. British photographer Don McCullen is a legend of the lens. He's known predominantly for his images of conflict, whether it's the Berlin Wall going up, the Troubles in Northern Ireland, or civilians caught in the crossfire from Uganda to Cambodia, and his images from the Vietnam War just maybe helped change history. McCullen's reportage from war zones around the world is rightly famous, but he's also known for his depiction of London, where he grew up in what was then scruffy old Finsbury Park, and the industrial northern cities of England, which hold a great place in McCullen's heart. More recently, he's taken to photographing landscapes, dark and brooding landscapes, that could be mistaken for battlefields at a glance. The breadth of McCullen's work is vast, and Tate Britain is currently holding a retrospective exhibition that spans 60 years of his career, starting in Finsbury Park and taking us through Berlin, India, Vietnam, Cyprus, the Congo, Beirut, and winding up back near his home in Somerset. Join me in the studio today to discuss this incredible exhibition are the director of Black Box Projects, Kathleen Fox-Davies, visual art editor for Time Out, Eddie Frankel, and the photographer, Zed Nelson. Welcome all to the programme. Great to have you all lending an ear to this, well, I called it an incredible show in the introduction. That's not really for me to say. It's for you three really to decide on that. Kathleen, talk us through what we see. How does the show work?
Okay. This is the Don McCullen retrospective. So you enter into Tate Britain, you pass the hallowed halls with the Henry Moores, and you walk into the very first ever photographic retrospective that the Tate Britain has hosted, which is not insignificant in itself. The exhibition consists of 250 hand-printed silver gelatin images framed on the wall as you would expect to be shown in an art gallery.
Production value.
Really,
it looks great.
Really lovely production value. The works are showed over 10 galleries, and it is an expansive, raw, and demanding exhibition. The images are not easy. You will question why we're looking at these things.
These are images
of war, conflict,
of suffering, of a lot of stuff. It mellows out at the end. It starts in Finsbury Park, as we said, but there's a lot of images that are tough to look at. Nonetheless, a lot of them are very famous images.
They're very famous. A lot of them are incredibly iconic, for lack of a better word. But as you walk through these, you're encountering, and you are forced to encounter, some really uncomfortable historical moments, moments that you might not actually have ever seen if you didn't live in Britain in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, when these would be a part of the Sunday Times or Observer's supplemental magazine spreads over the weekend. It does reach a fever pitch at some point about halfway through, and then it does start to pull it back and calm down. But it is an emotional journey, yeah, for lack of a better word. And I think it's an incredibly important exhibition. It is certainly a testament to six decades of work and commitment in some really difficult areas and in fields where most people wouldn't ever voluntarily go to provide witness. And it does stir a conscience in the viewer, which is exactly what it's intended to do.
My next question is kind of to both Zed and Eddie, actually. And it's kind of what is McCullen's gaze? What are we looking at? What is his eye kind of focused on as a photographer? And I'll ask Eddie first, as an art critic, aesthetically speaking, what are we looking at here?
I think it starts off really interestingly aesthetically when he's in Finsbury Park and then moves to Berlin to document the building of the Berlin Wall. I think he uses a lot of really interesting visual tricks. There's a huge amount of taking photos of other people taking photos, especially the Berlin bit. There's so many people looking at the camera or looking at other stuff. And as a sort of a conceptual thing, it's really smart. There's also a lot of walls, a lot of division. And when he goes to Northern Ireland, there's a series of a young kid chucking a stick at some soldiers. It's all based around a wall and so much division, so many neat metaphorical tricks. And I think aesthetically, it's really pleasing. I love it. They're very dark. He prints them himself, so they're
super, super dark.
Super right? dark, yeah. And really beautifully composed. After that, we're starting to talk about the aesthetics of war. And I think that is a really uncomfortable position to be in. Because I think it's one thing to go, oh, look, here's some teddy boys in Finsbury Park, and oh, here's the building of the Berlin Wall. But it's another entirely different thing to look at a dying Biafran child and think about the composition of the photograph and laud him for it. I think that puts the viewer in an uncomfortable position. Lots of them are beautiful photographs. He's obviously got an incredible eye, but it's an awkward position to be in, I think.
Okay, Zed, I'm going to let you tackle that one. As a photographer of all sorts of different projects, but one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today was about the fact that you've been to some tough places in the world. How do you square that? What can you show in a gallery that you can't show in a magazine, right, for example?
I mean, this is a big question. You know, yeah, there's a quote from the show, and he's written, "There are sites that should and do bring pain, shame and guilt." And in a way, that kind of hits to the nerve of what you're talking about. And I think it's something that he struggled with his whole life, which is whether you have, number one, a right to, you know, wade through someone else's misery and document it, then whether you have a right to put it in a magazine and benefit from it as an individual to some extent. And now we're faced with another question, will we have a right to see it in a big gallery? So they're all different arguments, and they all kind of contradict each other. And you talked about his early work, you know, the Teddy Boys and the sort of pictures of England.
So that was the first picture he sold to the Observer, I think, in 1958 or something, when he was...
And to me, they're not the most interesting, but what, in a way, that defines him is the raw interface with misery and horror. And so that, in a way, defines him and is the most awkward part. And you are faced with it. And the pictures become less clever, as you've suggested, in a way. They're more sort of face on, and you're being asked to look and to feel, to some degree, as he wrote, pain, shame and guilt.
Yeah.
And this was the intention. And the real question becomes, is it useful? Can we handle it? Does it do any good? What do we do with it?
I feel that that is a theme that which we will return back to. It's kind of like the big question. We should sort of see if we can answer it in some form by the end of our allotted time today. Eddie made a really interesting point, an aesthetic point, about the framing of some of the pictures. And he mentioned one of the young guy in Northern Ireland trying to hurl a plank of wood around a corner at British policemen in riot gear. And there is obviously, as you say, that amazing kind of that wall and that division. Is that something, as a photographer, you're always looking for? Or do you find that when you're going through your negatives at the end of the day, that it's happened by instinct?
Yeah, I think that happens partly, often by instinct. I mean, now photography is in some form of crisis in the contemporary world, where everyone is employing any device they can possibly do, trying to be conceptual, trying to sort of look at things from a completely different angle. A lot of it is desperate and pointless and silly. Some of it's brilliant, and it's hard for people to differentiate it sometimes. Whether he was doing that then, I'm not sure. I mean, I think he probably ended up at the Berlin Wall. But you're right, I noticed that too, that the included in the frame were other people with cameras and other onlookers. And as often as a photojournalist or a documentary photographer, one, particularly then, less so now, but you would exclude those awkward, annoying things that ruined the picture, which was a quite dishonest way of doing it. But you were kind of somehow trying to create an aesthetic that didn't include these little symbols of modern life or interference. So I quite liked what you pointed out, that it had all of that there. I wonder if it was intentional or not.
I think it's very of its time as well, because he, you know, thinking about film and art that was coming out then, sort of post-structuralist theory, people thinking about the gaze and how we're looking. I think it really, he's obviously, to me, it seems sort of obvious that he was thinking very big aesthetic thoughts about how he was looking at them and thinking about the gaze and looking, because it happens so much throughout so many of the photos that for it to be an accident would be a surprise.
He's quite gruff when he's talking about his own work and his own process, or rather he doesn't. He talks about the subject, but he doesn't talk about how he's done what he's done. I don't know whether that's a kind of like a bit of editorial sleight of hand on his behalf, or hiding his light under a bushel, or whether he kind of feels very much like a kind of force of nature with these photographs.
Well, I think that the images wouldn't resonate with the emotion and the power that they do with us and actually stir what they stir in you, whether it's shame, anger, sadness, if they weren't composed in such a way, if he wasn't such a fantastic visual storyteller. And I think we have to almost step back a bit, because we live in a world where everything is automatic and it's digital cameras where you can have a continuous shot that the shutter just goes and goes and goes with one click of your finger. He's working in analog film. He's having to load his camera. He's having to manually advance that film between each shot. And he takes time, and there's a delay from when he decides to click the shutter to take the picture to when it actually is captured. So when you see these, particularly when you get to the conflicts of Vietnam and Cambodia where they're action shots, it's incredible that he had the eye and the instinct to be there. Even with, he talks about the shell-shocked Marine, that was five images that he took slowly. And he talks about how that Marine never blinked, never moved. But about 4 minutes later, while everyone is still in that area, the house behind him was bombed. And he's just got incredible instinct. And that's also what he credits for his survival as well, is he knows when it's time to retreat, when it's time to, as he talks about, when a grenade went off and the soldier that was next to him didn't survive, but he knew that he needed to duck.
Yeah.
And I think those same instincts, and it could be from his rough upbringing, that he's just quick on his feet, or it could be that he's got a fantastic artistic eye. And he's combining those two things. And that's why he was so successful within the genre of photography and art that he did choose to go into.
Yeah, there's something of the streetwise and there's something of the buccaneering instinct about this. This was obviously, we're looking also at the golden age of photojournalism and reportage and magazines and newspapers having budgets and it becoming an unexpected thing to be able to see images like this. Let's come to that later, though. I wanted to ask you, Kathleen, about the curatorial, or all of you actually, about the curatorial idea of an exhibition like this. It's done chronologically, and obviously a lot of the work appeared in magazines and newspapers, and I wonder what the job of the curator is when it's been arranged by a photo editor, it's been laid out, and it's been a story. In fact, there is a video room, which is really interesting, which is a seven-hour loop of things from
which
the Sunday Times and the Sunday Times magazine and all the rest of it, which is kind of incredible. Man, people knew how to write a stand first in those days as well. But what's the curator's job when it's already been public, kind of consumed as magazine
stuff? A lot of the curator's job is about editing and about making sure that the story is told. And with a curator, it is a very deliberate story that they want to be told. And that's what they want you as the viewer to take away when you exit those galleries. This show, because it is a six-decade survey, and McCullum, I believe, has over 60,000 images to choose from. I wouldn't want the job of having to wade through that to pick the ones that, when you think of Don McCullum, you think of certain images. You've got to have those in, because that's what's going to draw people in. You also want to have the surprises that are there. And what I found the surprises was the graphic nature of the content, that I was not prepared for quite how deep they went into that, which I think is an important part of the story. Now, whether or not that was appropriate for a museum and public consumption, or whether that should have been in a war museum, or whether that should have been in a different setting, that's a whole nother conversation. But it was shown as in the context of fine art, and it's a big show. It's too much. The content is too much. The volume is too much. But I think that was the intention. It was to bombard you, and it was to create this emotional response within the viewer. And it was incredibly successful in that.
It's a curatorial decision, an aesthetic decision. If there's too much stuff, what do you leave out? Do you go, oh, we won't do Cambodia?
Well,
or something? You can't do that. So it is a funny way. It has to be about the kind of key stories he did and the key places he went and presumably the key people with which he felt sympathy, I suppose. Do you feel that there was a lot of it, Eddie?
Definitely. There's a huge amount of it, and I think that was the point, to sort of make you leave scarred and feel...
Because it seems like a very basic question, but actually there is obviously a reason why a lot of stuff has been included, and obviously there's been a massive edit as well, but...
You're meant to feel overwhelmed, you're meant to feel shocked, and I think that's a really great curatorial aim. I think it gets muddied because it's not actually about the subjects. It's about the subject being Don McCullen. Mm-hmm. So the curatorial aim is to say, isn't Don McCullen a wonderful photographer? Which, of course, he is.
Do you think he's very present all the time in these?
Yes, I mean, it's because no matter what, it's his lens, it's his view of history. And the thing that's amazing is that this guy shaped how we view all these conflicts. How incredible is it that shell-shocked Marine is one of the defining images of the time? That one man took that picture and defined how we view something. And that's incredible. But at the end of the day, what you walk out of there going is, Don McCollum was pretty amazing, wasn't he? And I think that's another thing I walked out of it struggling with, that because it stops being about the stories, it stops being about Biafra and about Vietnam, and it becomes about Don McCullen. Whenever I make a criticism of this show, I don't think I'm alone in it, because I think Don is probably there with me, because I think he felt uncomfortable and feels uncomfortable about those aspects.
Yeah, the ownership of the image and things. Zed, we didn't burn all our tinder in the green room before switching on the microphones, but we did have an interesting chat about, and Don McCullen addresses this in some of his wall texts, and it is obviously an ever-present thought for photographers with any kind of sense of themselves, is asking permission to take people's portraits, especially when they're in straitened circumstances. How do you approach that yourself?
Well, he talks a little bit about that in the show, which he says often he looks people in the eye looking for some kind of unspoken approval to continue. And I think that's usually all you can do. And he also talked about being close enough that he was never photographing people without them knowing he was there. So, and I'm assuming that if people objected or, you know, became unhappy, he would leave. Some wouldn't, but I think he would. So I think really that's it. That's what you do. That's what you can do. And then, you know, backtracking.
And there is a kind of very obvious moral line over which you do not step, or you tend not to, when you're in somewhere dangerous, or you are seeing a wonderful image or an image that is meaningful and shocking and powerful. You always need permission. Is that a kind of photographer's code?
You have to give yourself permission all the time. Yeah. You have to work out why you're there and what you're doing, whether it's useful. So you're not always looking for individual permission. You may be struggling with the point of being there. So if you're, as he did, photographing the grieving relatives of someone who's just been murdered in Cyprus.
Yeah, that was really affecting, I thought.
How you can't intellectualise it all in that moment. All you can do is read the situation, and often people allow you to take photographs in those situations because in that moment of abject horror and misery and confusion, I think there's a sense that you may do them some good, that the world kind of needs to know, that it's a cliche, but the idea of bearing witness to something.
Yeah.
So you then enter this awful contract with the person you're photographing to actually deliver on all of those promises. And that's where people get messed up afterwards. And I think Don McCullen certainly has wrestled with that all of his life. The question of, did it do any good? Because I have that contract with every single person I photographed. And I think that's quite a burden.
It's it's a funny thing. I mean, I haven't seen this addressed in the book. We've got the book in front of me here from the exhibition. I'm actually reading his autobiography because I wanted to do a bit of further reading. And he explores it a lot himself in his in his autobiography, but in that kind of gruff way, in a kind of like one line in a chapter, kind of like why, and it's down to sort of why them and not me. A bit like survivor guilt. And as you say, the slight guilt of bearing witness to something sort of, an atrocity.
Yeah.
Question for all of you. Is it facile of me to see some very great beauty in this? And I'm not talking about the landscapes and Palmyra, which has a sort of haunting beauty of destruction. It seemed to me that a lot of these pictures, despite the deprivation of some of them, were kind of very beautiful.
They are beautiful. And I don't think that that's...
Is that the wrong word to use?
I don't think that's
Eddie's
wrong
at all.
Eddie's
making a face.
I don't feel like that's wrong at all. You don't have the same guilt if you're approaching Goya, who was documenting conflict where he was, or even Picasso's Guernica that was talking about what he was. It's the immediacy. It's because it's a photograph. But if you remove yourself from that, which might be difficult, it might be removing the human element of the reasons why they were taken. But they are beautiful pictures. They are masterfully printed, and we can talk about composition and references to art historical tropes. It's all there, and they're very well thought out, which is why they are so incredible. And it's why he is Don McCullum instead of us talking about someone else that might have been working with the U.S. troops in Vietnam at the same time, or in Cambodia, or, I mean, part of it is that he was going to a lot of the places that no one else wanted to and seeking out this conflict and things.
And in that, you do see a bit of the ego of the artist, mm. and in the sense that obviously this lifestyle becomes addictive.
Yeah, but
not being in a war zone, it's adrenaline, right? And not being in a place of, that's dangerous, or kind of having the fear of missing out of some awful thing happening somewhere in some corner of the world. It's quite a dark thing. I mean, have you... I know you kind of changed your modus operandi, Zed, right. to kind of cut that out. For one of the reasons was some of McCullen's work, maybe.
Well, McCullen's autobiography made me rethink whether I wanted to spend a lifetime doing that
doing
kind
up a
of work,
jacket
let's say.
The whole time.
No, I've always been uncomfortable with it. Even when I would go to war zones or countries that were sort of being torn apart by conflict, I had my own rules, and often they were, I would only go to places that were being ignored, that the sort of world's media weren't there, and that there was something not being spoken about. And then it got very problematic, because you had to then constantly question whether what you were doing was useful. So, and times have changed. I mean, when Don McCullen was working, some of those images have become, you could say, photographic cliches, you know, sort of the mother and child, the sort of Madonna and child. I did that myself in Somalia, you know, in a famine. And I remember looking at the picture thinking, I've followed this tradition of photographing misery in a certain way. It's shocking and it's also beautiful, and it references art history. And it's becoming harder and harder to justify doing those things in the kind of internet age. Some of what he did, I think, is more forgivable and laudable because, A, it hadn't become a cliche. Two, it was on the front page of a major newspaper at a time when politicians would read it and an enormous gathering of people would see that, and potentially you could shift public opinion. Whereas now it's harder, everything's gone on the internet and magazines have dissipated, and it's much harder to reach an audience. And then when you do, we're all inundated with not only images, but also we're much more cynical. We've had WikiLeaks and everything else, and we sort of don't believe in anything, we don't trust anything. So it's a real kind of toxic little soup that we're in.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the strengths of a show like this, one of the reasons of its strength possibly is its largesse, is the fact that it's making a very bold play for the importance of photography in shaping history,
exactly.
and shaping us, what, you know, how we understand it, in a world where kind of photography and journalism generally has been a bit bastardized. Do you know what I mean, Eddie? I mean, yeah. I kind of feel like we talked about this before we switched on the microphones, the idea of how close you can get to the front line, one's contract with the military, if you're embedded, how all that kind of stuff works. This was kind of a different time. And although there is some gung-ho-ness and buccaneeringness in some of the images, or maybe in the derring-do by which they were shot, it surely is an important statement just by its very existence.
Of course, I don't think there's anything wrong in finding beauty in any of the images, because beauty is one of the tools a photographer can use to capture something. It's in the same way as a war journalist can use beautiful writing to tell their story. I don't think there's any problem with that. I think the problem comes up more when you're asking, when are we doing this? Why are we doing this? And why are we looking at them? That's when the beauty takes over the purpose. And that's the complicated bit for me.
The last two rooms, maybe it's the last room of the exhibition at Tate Britain, are McCullen's landscapes, some really haunting ones of the smashed up temples of Palmyra and places in Syria. And then the rest are brooding landscapes around his house in Somerset. What do we think of these? Kathleen, do these feel like light relief? I mean, they're printed, if possible, even darker than some of his images of Vietnam and things.
They should have been light relief. It's easy to joke that the last room was landscapes.
And
out of you know, taken out of his kitchen window. That's where he's retired to and is processing everything else he's seen. But he is still approaching the landscape in the same way. He's only photographing in the winter months when it's quite barren landscape. I mean, Somerset's one of the most beautiful places in England, if not this side of the world. And he's choosing the cold, bitter, misty months where the trees have a skeletal aspect to them instead of, you know, beautifully in bloom. There is still very much that foreboding darkness, and how he's composing the landscapes are in the same way as he would photograph, or you would see photograph a battlefield after the fact. And he's still relating to his world in the same way that he did the two, the three, the four decades previous in the galleries that you saw before. But I do like that he's not just hung up his camera. He's not just taken up gardening. This is a mind at work. This is a creative eye. And he's continuing. And it's interesting because with this retrospective, he does say that he can see sort of the horizon of where this photographic journey is going to end. And I think very much in perhaps his complete unconscious, he's seeing what sort of legacy he's going to leave now, even to the point where he's still going to areas such as Iraq and Syria and in documenting not so much the people, but the destruction that we are creating in the wake of our conflicts and the dismantling of World Heritage sites and what's left behind.
Yeah.
And I think that he's thinking about what he's also leaving behind when he's taking those. So it is a really nice way of end capping quite a tough show that I thought it was beautiful. I was ready to dismiss them.
I found those quite moving in the same way that some of those portraits are and some of those real war-torn places. I found them really profoundly affecting, actually. I loved them. So finally, we promised we'd try and nail this one. It's impossible to do so, but I will rattle the cage again. Does it do any good?
Oh, God. Probably you said it.
Sorry,
out,
Zed.
Straight out. Look, I mean, when you look at the slideshow...
It's like saying Macbeth in the theatre, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But in the exhibition, there's a slideshow of all of his magazine. There's like... He had 52 magazine covers. He worked for the Sunday Times for, I can't remember, 18 years.
Yep.
And so you see this enormous volume of work. And, you know, when you look at the spreads of, you know, the war zones and the things about Biafra and Cyprus, and a lot of these were conflicts that were being ignored or, you know, people didn't quite understand. So there is an argument that it was important, despite all of the cynicism about whether anything really changes. And often, as I found, you know, you think you're exposing something, but actually your own government has been the architect of that very situation in their politicking. So it doesn't go very deep in unpacking all of these political issues, but I do think his work cut to the core of something. And then one thing we haven't said is that it doesn't glamorize war, and most war photographers inadvertently or on purpose do it. And I think the power of his pictures is that they strip away any shred of glamour. And I think that's the power of them.
Beautifully put. Thank you, everyone. Don McCullen's work is on show at Tate Britain until the 6th of May. Thank you very much to my guests today, Kathleen Fox-Davies, Zed Nelson and Eddie Frankel. Thanks too to my producer, Holly Fisher, and studio producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Next week, we'll be continuing our look at conflict reportage when we take a look at the film A Private War, the biopic of the late war correspondent Marie Colvin. I'll be joined by the director, Matthew Heineman, and photographer, Paul Conroy. But until then, from me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.